Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 2nd of June, these are our main stories. Leading right-wing figures in the Israeli government have threatened to pull out if Benjamin Netanyahu agrees to a peace plan announced by President Biden. Boeing's efforts to send astronauts to the International Space Station have suffered another setback, with a launch being stopped at the last minute. Polls have closed in India after the biggest general election ever held. Also in this podcast,
you can feel the touch of Vincent's hand when he painted it, and it's there with full force of his vision.
Starry Night Over the Rhone by the Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh has returned to the French city of Arles, where he painted it in 1888. We start in Israel, where right-wing coalition partners are threatening to bring down the government if the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agrees to a plan put forward by President Biden to end the war in Gaza. Mr. Biden unveiled the three-stage plan on Friday. In a post on social media, which we voiced up, Mr. Netanyahu repeated that there will be no permanent ceasefire until Hamas was destroyed.
Israel's conditions for ending the war have not changed. The destruction of Hamas military and governing capabilities, the freeing of all hostages, and ensuring that Gaza no longer poses a threat to Israel. Under the proposal, Israel will continue to insist these conditions are met before a permanent ceasefire is put in place. The notion that Israel will agree to a permanent ceasefire before these conditions are fulfilled is a non-starter.
This contrasted with a much more positive response from Hamas's Bassam Naim. He said it would accept the deal if Israel did.
It depends on the Israeli reactions and acceptance to this deal. If they are ready to go to the deal, Hamas will go for this deal. At the end, it is not about Hamas. It is not about the resistance. It is about Palestinian people who are looking for their freedom and dignity. We are attacking the aggression for 75 years, the occupation, the apartheid regime. It is our right to fight our dignity.
We asked Tal Schneider, political and diplomatic correspondent for the Times of Israel, whether the coalition would collapse if Mr. Netanyahu accepted this deal.
Probably yes. That's a good outcome, however, because this government doesn't have the trust of the Israeli people after the mass failure of October 7th. So if that will be the case, many people here will not be sad about it. The only problem is that Netanyahu doesn't want to go that way. Obviously, those two ministers who are opposing this deal are from the very far extreme right wing of Israel. And it's sad that they are now in power. But one of them already opposed the previous deal where 105 women and kids and elderly and foreign workers, by the way, Thais and Nepal, were released. So he opposed that previous deal. It's a tough decision. The government will not survive when the deal is done and when the goals achieved. Probably it will have to go to election anyhow. So it's not a big temptation to Netanyahu to count on that. Even so, if he wants to do it, he has the help from the opposition. Not just him, many other people in the opposition will support him if he's putting this deal for a vote. It doesn't need to put it for a vote at the plenum, by the way. It only needs a majority in the government. That's the problem with his leadership. It doesn't make the call. And I think the reason President Biden went out on Friday night and just announced what the deal is, he just revealed all of the details, is exactly because it doesn't want Netanyahu to have excuses or a way out.
Tal Schneider. Well, the US, Egypt and Qatar, as mediators in the negotiations, have issued a joint statement calling on Hamas and Israel to accept the proposals. But what pressure will the US exert on Israel, given that Friday's announcement was President Biden's first major address outlining how the war in Gaza might end? Our Washington correspondent is Will Vernon.
Well, I think we saw that pressure come to fruition, didn't we? Last month, when President Biden, in an interview with CNN, announced that he had paused one shipment of heavy weapons destined for Israel, the kind of weapons he said that could be used in major population centres such as Rafah, and other shipments he said were under review. And that was a major announcement. This was the first time in a long time, perhaps 30 years, that the US had withheld weapons shipments to Israel for this reason. But I think what you've got here is a really tricky situation for President Biden. He made that very optimistic White House address on Friday in which he said it's time for this war to end and for the day after to begin. Pretty grand words, setting out this comprehensive proposal for a three-stage peace plan. And I think Mr. Biden is desperately hoping that Israel and Hamas will agree to it. And he tried, didn't he, in that speech to draw a line under the conflict. But as you say, we've had the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in these comments he made on Saturday, taking perhaps some of the shine off of that Biden announcement by reiterating Israel's position that the war will not end without the complete destruction of Hamas, all its military and governing capabilities, as Mr. Netanyahu put it.
And it's not the first time Mr. Biden has talked optimistically about there being an end to the conflict soon, only for those hopes to be dashed.
That's right. And optimistic he has to be, because he is under a huge amount of pressure here at home, not only from the Republicans in Congress, who are accusing Mr. Biden of basically abandoning a key U.S. ally in the Middle East, but also from Democrats, progressives, people in his own party who are very unhappy indeed with the Biden administration's support for Israel. Because despite all these differences of opinion over how Israel is conducting the war, America remains Israel's most important ally, its largest supplier of military equipment. America still guarantees Israel security. Ironclad, right, is the word that Mr. Biden and other U.S. officials have used many times to describe that guarantee. Just a few days ago, several U.S. media reported that American-supplied weapons were involved in an attack in Rafah. That strike and the resulting fire, of course, claimed the lives of dozens of Palestinian civilians, and that only amplified the criticism of Mr. Biden's support for Israel. So he really is under a huge amount of pressure from all sides, and in a crucial election year here. So, of course, the White House will now be desperately hoping that both sides can finally agree to this deal.
Will Vernon, the American aerospace giant Boeing has failed in its latest attempt to fly its first crew to the International Space Station. The launch of its Starliner spaceship with two veteran astronauts on board was halted in the final minutes of countdown from Cape Canaveral in Florida. Boeing's computer systems flagged up a problem. The cause is being investigated. A few minutes after the launch was halted, this is how a NASA commentator explained the situation.
The mission, the NASA Boeing's crew flight test of the Boeing Starliner, was scrubbed at 12:21 p.m. Eastern Time when a hold was issued by the ground launch sequencer for the Atlas V rocket. It was at T-minus 3 minutes and 50 seconds, just a little less than 4 minutes before liftoff when that abort was called. The crew of Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, who are inside the capsule at the top of this rocket, they are awaiting the arrival of the blue team to come out to the launch pad and help them egress, which essentially means get out of the Starliner capsule and head back to crew quarters.
There may be another attempt to launch the rocket on Sunday. A successful launch would have made Boeing the second commercial operator to ferry crews to the ISS after Elon Musk's SpaceX. Boeing's previous attempt was aborted hours before liftoff. We got more on the background to the delay from our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
We came so close. All the flight controllers, one after another, said go, 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 but the computer said no. That was just less than 4 minutes before the launch. The ground launch system, as it's called, is a piece of software. It didn't load. NASA and Boeing don't know why that is. It could either be that it spotted something that the flight controllers didn't, and there might be a problem with one of the components on the system, or it could just be a software fault. If it's the latter, then that could be quickly fixed, and they might have another go. But if it's one of the systems, then it could take a lot longer.
else is part of this programme?
So the main party is Boeing. Mm-hmm. They're the company that has taken on SpaceX, Elon Musk's SpaceX, to provide competition for the contract to send supplies and crews and astronauts to the International Space Station. There's also the United Launch Alliance, who are the people that have got the rocket. The spacecraft is the bit on top. And, of course, there is NASA. So between the three of them, they wanted to get this first crewed test flight off the ground. Unfortunately, it's been delayed and delayed because of various technical issues. And this is just the latest part of this long story, but I think what Boeing would say is that after all these delays having come so close, it's probably worth waiting an extra day or so, particularly as there were astronauts on board. Better safe than sorry.
Okay, and very quickly, there have been other parties who have managed crewed missions.
Well, that's right. Notably, Elon Musk's SpaceX. Boeing and SpaceX were offered the contract at the same time to develop a system to go to the International Space Station. Elon Musk's SpaceX got there in 2020. So they're still behind, but Boeing can hope that it'll fix the problem and catch up as soon as it can.
Palab Ghosh speaking to Lukwesa Burak. Next to South Africa, where political parties are gearing up for coalition talks after the African National Congress, the party once led by Nelson Mandela, suffered its worst election results since the end of apartheid. The ANC won around 40% of the vote in Wednesday's election, a sharp drop from the last one, meaning it will have to share power for the first time in order to continue governing. Our Africa correspondent, Barbara Pletasha, reports from Johannesburg.
There was a late-night flurry of activity here when the former president Jacob Zuma paid a visit. He was mobbed by supporters and journalists. Mr. Zuma is the head of the upstart MK party. It came in third, but has claimed there's evidence of election rigging and said it might challenge the results in court. Already it has taken a lot of votes from the ANC, which is also reeling from voter anger over economic mismanagement and corruption scandals. This is the most dramatic political shift since the end of apartheid. The chair of the Electoral Commission, Mosutu Moapia, said it needs to be managed well.
We ask for all electoral stakeholders to please remain calm, for leaders to lead this nation at this time, and for voices of reason to continue to prevail. This is a moment that we need to manage and manage well.
The ANC is still the biggest party, but it's lost its majority and is preparing to begin complex coalition talks. There are no easy fits. The leader of the left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters, Julius Malema, said he wanted to work with the ANC, but he sounded like a fighter.
We are happy because we have achieved our mission in our lifetime. And that mission was to bring the ANC below 50%. That's what we have always told you, that this animal is going to be eaten piece by piece.
South Africans face weeks of turbulent coalition talks. They voted for change, but don't know yet what it will be.
Barbara Pletasha. It's taken 6 weeks, involved nearly a billion people, but now India's mammoth elections have finally ended, with a seventh and final round being held as much of the country is battling a heat wave, with temperatures soaring above 40 degrees Celsius in many places. The votes are now being counted and the results are expected on Tuesday. Exit polls project the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, will win a third term. But our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain in Delhi, told us they should be taken with a pinch of salt.
These exit polls are not always the most reliable. However, what's interesting is when you're looking across the board, we're seeing that a lot of these exit polls are saying that they're expecting a BJP-led coalition government and not an outright win for the Bharatiya Janata Party, the ruling party in India.
So we're waiting for the results to come in. It will still take a few more days. One factor which has probably affected turnout, which seems to have affected turnout, is the heat wave that India is currently experiencing.
Right. So if you look at the last few phases of the election, we saw that voter turnout was in the low 60s. And if you look at other election phases, we saw a much higher turnout. And there are many people that are actually attributing that to the extreme heat. I mean, in the last 2 weeks, parts of northern India were under extreme heat advisories, the temperatures hitting over 50 degrees Celsius in some locations. So you even had election officials that were taking great precautions, offering cold drinks, water, and misting fans at polling booths to try and encourage more people to come out and vote, but also to alleviate some of the pressure that exists for those that were standing in line as there was so much heat.
Samira Hussain. Stars twinkling in the night sky, a couple strolling by the river, and gas lamps reflected in the water. Starry Night Over the Rhone, a work by the Dutch artist Vincent van Gogh, has returned to the French city of Arles for the first time since he painted it in 1888. The painting, on loan from the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, is being displayed in Provence as part of an exhibition, Van Gogh and the Stars. Leila Natu spoke to Biche Kuriger, the exhibition's co-curator.
This is really a great moment for the people in the city and, yes, for me, for all the people who worked here for 10 years. It's also our anniversary, so it's great day.
Do you think it changes somebody's viewing experience, someone's experience of this painting, to see it so close to its actual location and then being able to actually go there for themselves, perhaps, to the scene that is depicted?
Yes, it's really magic to be in the spot a couple of hundred meters away and see the original of an image that has been so over-reproduced and reproduced and globally distributed, and suddenly you see the original and you can feel the touch of Vincent's hand when he painted it, and it's there with the full force of his vision he had about telling us something, what it is, looking at the night up in the sky and having a moment of greater feeling about our life and our being on Earth, looking up in the universe.
How does it compare now, the view that he, where he sat and painted that painting? What's different now?
It's actually, Arles hasn't changed so much when you stand at the same spot where he was standing in a night in 1888. Still the same shoreline, and you can imagine that constellation of the stars can come back exactly in the same way, because there is an astronomical justice which he really depicted. But at the same time, you can think back in the 19th century how it was when suddenly the night was illuminated with gas lights, because that had just happened 7 years before he painted the painting, that these lamps were installed. And he was not against modernity. He didn't come down to the south in this small city after having lived in London and in Paris. And he knew exactly what modern cities, what the transformation of the world in the 19th century meant.
Biche Kuriger. Still to come in this podcast.
Until 50 years ago, if someone was choking, all that was likely to happen was that they would be slapped on the back.
But we'll tell you how that all changed thanks to one man, Henry Heimlich.
I'm Suzanne Wilton, and for more than two decades, I've been searching for the truth behind the world's largest gold hoax.
We were sitting on one of the largest gold deposits that the world had ever found.
A mother lode across the world in Indonesia.
A billion-dollar con on a scale never seen before or since.
It looks like they've invented the deposit.
This is a scam.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
People were willing to roll the dice at any cost.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. The owner of Ticketmaster, Live Nation, has confirmed that hackers have accessed customer data. This comes days after the hacking group Shiny Hunters claimed to have stolen the personal details of more than 500 million Ticketmaster customers. Our business reporter Simon Browning told us what was known about the hack.
500 million customers, you just said it. This is a massive attack. It's a significant attack. Ticketmaster is known around the world if you like music, concerts, theatre, festivals, showbiz, pop stars. The rest of it, you're likely to have bought tickets through Ticketmaster. And lots of us will have signed up and given it. It's our personal information, addresses, credit card details, etc. Now, the first rumours about this came out on Thursday when the hackers said they'd done it. But there was no confirmation at that stage. But this morning, in a filing to the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, Live Nation, the owners of Ticketmaster, confirmed it had been targeted in a cyber attack. Now, Ticketmaster and Live Nation haven't confirmed that 500 million figure that we've been given by the hackers. They're called Shiny Hunters, and they claim that they have got names, addresses, phone numbers, partial credit cards. They're demanding $500,000 of ransom money from Live Nation Ticketmaster's owners to prevent our data then being sold on the black market, which is where the risk comes to all of us, people who are customers, and what they have stored with them.
So we haven't got the full details yet from Ticketmaster, but how damaging is this for them?
It's a very difficult situation. We've been talking to security experts and cybersecurity experts all day today. They are saying this could be one of the biggest cybersecurity hacks in history. There are a huge amount of tickets, ticket holders, personal information. There are tours going on around the world. I've been looking all day today. Taylor Swift, one of the biggest artists in the world. Many of her concert tickets are sold within Ticketmaster, and parents are worried about because their kids are asking, are my tickets going to be safe? I mean, this is a big deal for Ticketmaster. They have responded in a statement today saying that they are doing all they can to mitigate any risk and they will be contacting anybody who they believe has had unauthorised access to personal information. But they say this is a criminal threat and the company is doing all it can.
And huge hacks like this seem to be more and more frequent. What can we do to protect ourselves?
Protection is critical, isn't it? And we hear from cybersecurity experts all the time, passwords, all the time. Not repeating passwords, not using the same phrases, developing key phrases. Today I've been speaking to Lisa Forte. She is a cybersecurity expert, and she gave us some tips on what to do if you start to receive some phishing emails.
Scammers, fraudsters are likely to be sending emails, sending text messages, pretending to be involved in some way, maybe pretending even to be Ticketmaster. So you've got to be very careful. If you receive an email or text message, do not click on any link. Do not enter any details into anything.
Lisa mentions they're not clicking. Opportunistic scammers will be taking every opportunity now. It's global news that Ticketmaster has been hacked and they will be taking every chance to expose that risk to people. So be very careful and think about what you do in relation to any contact you get about this.
Simon Browning. A simple saliva test is proving more effective at identifying men at high risk of prostate cancer than standard blood tests, according to early data. Cancer research bodies in Britain have said it promises to turn the tide on the early diagnosis and treatment of a cancer that kills nearly 400,000 men a year worldwide. Professor Caroline Moore is a consultant urologist specialising in the detection and minimally invasive treatment of prostate cancer. James Menendez asked her, how does this new test work?
They get sent a saliva tube. They put their sample into that and post it off. The saliva is analysed for the DNA, looking for markers of genetic risk for prostate cancer. So it will then give a risk profile, higher than average or lower than average at risk of prostate cancer.
How accurate is it?
It's not a diagnostic test for prostate cancer, but it shows that you might have a higher chance of having prostate cancer and therefore having some of the other tests, the prostate specific antigen blood test or perhaps an MRI scan might be particularly useful for you.
But does it look like it's better at predicting cases of prostate cancer than the blood test?
It does, yeah. So for the people who had the saliva test and then went on to have prostate cancer, nearly 80% of them had a normal blood test. So if all they'd had was the blood test, they'd have been reassured.
What is the problem with the blood test? Because it picks up false positives, doesn't it? Why is that?
So it's called prostate-specific antigen, and it's specific to the prostate gland, but not to prostate cancer. So you can have a high level of the PSA blood test if you've got a big prostate, or if you've got, say, a urine infection, and you can also have a low level and still have a prostate cancer.
And obviously that then wastes, I mean, it's not good for the patient, is it? But it also wastes time and resources for doctors.
That's exactly right. So that's why we don't have a formal screening programme for prostate cancer. Although it's the commonest cancer in men in the UK and it's the second commonest cause of cancer death, there isn't a screening programme like there is for other cancers because so far the tests haven't been good enough.
So the saliva test will pick up more cases and fewer false positives.
That's the hope. And the next step for it is to assess it in a trial called Transform, where we're doing a large screening study, but we're also using the PSA blood test and different forms of MRI. And then we'll be able to see what's the most effective test or probably combination of tests to find the important cancers early.
Professor Caroline Moore. Now, it's 50 years since the invention of a life-saving technique that has saved thousands of people from choking to death. The Heimlich manoeuvre was devised by an American surgeon called Henry Heimlich, as Terry Egan explains.
Until 50 years ago, on Saturday, if someone was choking, all that was likely to happen was that they would be slapped on the back. That, though, is something that might even make things worse. Henry Heimlich had a better idea. Realising it was the airway that was getting blocked, he thought you could use the lungs themselves to solve the problem. Trying this out on dogs, none of which were harmed by the trials, he discovered the best method was to compress the diaphragm, usually from behind. That squeezes the lungs and increases the air pressure within the windpipe and voice box. It's aggressive, but certainly dislodges whatever's blocking the airway. Because the problem occurred most in cafes and restaurants, Heimlich wrote an essay entitled Pop Goes the Café Coronary, explaining the procedure. And the technique took off. It saved its first life soon afterwards, and went on to prevent many others, among them the former president Ronald Reagan and the singer Cher, from dying by choking.
Terry Egan. It may have felt like deja vu for football fans. Once again, the Spanish football giants, Real Madrid, are champions of Europe for a record 15th time. In the Champions League final, they beat the German side Borussia Dortmund 2-0. But Dortmund certainly put up a fight, as we heard from our sports reporter, George Addo, who was watching the game.
I thought they came very, very close to winning this Champions League final. In the first 45 minutes, they totally dominated Real Madrid, the 14-time champions. We had an interesting start at the end of 45 minutes. Real Madrid had not forced a save out of the Dortmund goalkeeper. They had two great opportunities to score, but were not able to put the ball at the back of the net. So clearly in the first 45 minutes, they were the side that showed that they were able to match Real Madrid despite the quality they had on paper. However, in the second half, like Real Madrid have done all season and have done over the period in the Champions League, they came back able to put up a better performance, and they most importantly just took the opportunities when they had it. Dani Carvajal with a fantastic goal there from a corner, and Vinicius Junior finishing it off, winning it by 2-0. In the end, even from the analysis from the second half, it could have been 3-0, which would not have been a very great reflection of the kind of result we had because of how close Dortmund played and how close they were to winning it. But it's Real Madrid, and that's why they won the Champions League 15 times. So Dortmund came close, but it wasn't close enough.
And how do you think Real Madrid were able to do this? Because it did appear at the beginning, as you say, as if Dortmund could win this game.
Yeah, in the first half, they allowed Dortmund to really go loose, especially when they had them on the counter-attack. And so they needed a bit of tightening up in the midfield, which they did. And it's normally a mental thing, because Carlo Ancelotti, the Real Madrid boss, has said time and time and again that he does not approach a game with a specific tactic. He just keeps on, you know, tweaking until everything works out there. I think in this game was mentally. I'm sure that the talk in the dressing room was important for them, because they came out the second half and they began to play. They began to show that the goal-scoring threat that they've had all season. And then we saw them massing up there in the midfield and beginning to take on Dortmund like they were not doing in the first half. And I feel that that's exactly what made the difference for them. That cutting edge that has separated them oftentimes just came back in there and were able to get those important goals. After the first goal, it was very, very difficult for Dortmund to come back. They scored a goal to Fulgret, but that goal was disallowed. And in the end, there was just no way. Once again, the mental side of Real Madrid showing and just giving us an indication of how great they've been.
George Addo. Now from sport to showbiz. The singer Jennifer Lopez, known for hits like this, has cancelled her US tour, which was supposed to come off the back of her first album in 5 years. She told fans she was taking time off to be with her children, family and close friends. This comes as rumours are swirling that her marriage to the Hollywood actor Ben Affleck may be in trouble. But there are also reports that ticket sales have been poor. The couple, known as Bennifer, first started dating in 2002, but broke up, married other people before then getting back together. Our entertainment reporter, Guy Lambert, told us more.
This tour comes off the back of Jennifer Lopez's 9th studio album titled This Is Me Now. It was released 20 years after her hit album This Is Me Then. And it's her first album for 5 years, as you say. The tour was due to kick off in Orlando on the 26th of June. And it's going to be 2 months long, covering North America, and due to conclude in Houston at the end of August. But that's all over now. The ticketing company Live Nation announced on Friday that the summer tour was cancelled, saying the singer is taking time off to be with her children, her family and her close friends. Live Nation has assured fans in a statement that they will be automatically getting their money back in a refund. And J.Lo has also addressed her fans through her On the J.Lo newsletter, where she wrote that she was completely heartsick and devastated about letting the fans down. And she wouldn't have to do this if she didn't feel that it was absolutely necessary.
Interesting choice of word there, heartsick, because there's been all this speculation about the state of her marriage to Ben Affleck. The two only got married, 2 years ago?
A lot of speculation that's been mounting as to why this tour has been cancelled. I mean, firstly, away from the marriage, there have been reports of poor ticket sales from the start, leading to cancelled dates on their own. There's been a relatively poor reception for this new album. It only peaked at 38 in the Billboard Top 200 in the US. But yes, the statement saying that she wants to take time to be with her children and her family does suggest that this is closer to home, and speculation does continue about the state of Jennifer Lopez's marriage to Ben Affleck. She was asked about this at a junket for her new sci-fi movie Atlas last week, and naturally it was something she refused to engage with. But the couple have been seen out in public together earlier this week. They were at Ben Affleck's daughter's graduation ceremony. So yes, making public appearances, but for now what we do know is that currently J.Lo's priorities are more with her family rather than actually touring and promoting this new album.
Guy Lambert. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Annie Smith. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Suzanne Wilton, and for more than two decades, I've been searching for the truth behind the world's largest gold hoax.
We were sitting on one of the largest gold deposits that the world had ever found.
A mother lode across the world in Indonesia.
A billion-dollar con on a scale never seen before or since.
It looks like they've invented the deposit.
This is a scam.
And the deeper I dig, the more questions I unearth.
People were willing to roll the dice at any cost.
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.